it is also a game that you can spend hundreds of hours in because there's so many different ways to do things.
Little things like the way that the grass moves when the wind is blowing.
I think it's interesting. So the four main civilizations, you have like fish people, rock people, bird people, and women.
Breath of the Wild stays true to both of those things. Welcome back to Replay, everyone, a podcast about pop culture, entertainment, and two people just generally nerding out. How's it going, Shama?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm very much looking forward to this episode about a video game that we have been eager to talk about on the show for quite some time, and I can't wait to get into it.
Yeah, and we actually just a couple months ago went to Comic-Con in Toronto, and so that was very on theme for this episode. We had a lot of like nerd stuff to see and talk about. So what were your impressions of Comic-Con Toronto this year?
Yeah, Comic-Con, I've never been before. Thank you for dragging me out there. It was extremely crowded, so it was like a lot. It was very intense. The costumes were generally fantastic. A lot of people going all out. A lot of characters, especially, you know, like the anime stuff. I'm like, I have no clue what's going on here. It looks super cool. But I did recognize a whole lot of different characters from, you know, Mortal Kombat to Cowboy Bebop and just other really good stuff. And there was a lot of cool exhibits. A lot of nice art, some questionable art that wasn't so good. Some of Comic-Con is not safe for kids, I would say. We had a lot of conversation about that while we were there. But generally, I was like really glad to go. It was a definitely worthwhile, if incredibly overwhelming experience.
Yeah, I mean, there were inappropriate like young girl drawings with lots of boobs everywhere. So that, I think, was maybe a less like positive part of it, but otherwise, yeah, the art was really interesting. I was looking for stuff from some of my favorite games. Like I got prints, I got a print of Aloy from Horizon and one of Geralt from Witcher, and they're like both in the same style, so I could get them framed and put them up somewhere like really like beautiful. I got the Korok tree and some Koroks, and so, you know, this is anticipating our topic for today, but I always think that the Koroks are the most powerful beings in Hyrule, so I got that, and a little smaller illustration of Garrus from Mass Effect. Garrus is my Mass Effect boyfriend, so, like, he's on my fridge now. So yeah, it was really nice. And so this was my first Comic-Con after getting into video games, because I used to go and just be more like I was looking for Star Trek stuff, or like I didn't really know anything about video games. But during the deep pandemic, having like various genres of like mental breakdown of isolation, well, very, very much at the start of the pandemic, I got a Switch, like most people at that point, and played Animal Crossing. So that was my gateway. And then Zelda Breath of the Wild, Witcher, Skyrim. And about a year and a half ago, I got a PlayStation. So yeah, I've been playing lots of PlayStation games and stuff too. So it was really great to like recognize a lot of things this year that in like previous years, I would not have known anything about.
Mm-hmm. I also got a Nintendo Switch during the early part of the pandemic. So I am a gamer now, And the truth is, video games, a lot of it for me is about nostalgia. Even Comic-Con for me, the enjoyment of it was a lot about nostalgia, things that I really loved and appreciated when I was a kid. Probably the most captivating game I played when I was young. The first game that wasn't just like, you know, a Mario game or a fun like sports NHL game that you just like sit in the basement and burn your retina into the screen playing with your friends for hours. The first game that had a story and a kind of, I don't know, a mood that I was really super into was a game called The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past. I still kind of feel like this is the best video game ever made. That's my take. Everybody's got their own personal feelings about these things. But the game we are going to talk about today, Breath of the Wild, is one of the more recent games in that Zelda series franchise. Zelda is the name of a princess of Hyrule, but the protagonist in the games is Link. And one thing I love about the way that many of these games, I haven't played most of them, there's just so much Zelda lore and games and content that we cannot get into here. So for those of you who are like super into the iceberg, I'm sorry, this is not going to be that. But in many of the Zelda games, they begin with two things: Link being asleep and being woken up by some circumstance that sets him on an adventure. And they continue with Link never speaking ever throughout the course of the game. Breath of the Wild stays true to both of those things. Link awakens after being asleep for 100 years. He doesn't know that he's been asleep for 100 years. He wakes up in his home kingdom of Hyrule and meets a mysterious old man who kind of starts giving him guidance and clues and testing him, essentially, as it were, to find out how much of a real hero he really is. And eventually this old man reveals himself to Link as a ghost, the ghost of King Rome, who was the king 100 years prior in Hyrule, when everything was peaceful and everything was great. And what happened was an evil force known as Calamity Ganon. Ganon is the bad guy in the Link series. Ganon was kind of banished. He was gone. Everybody was chilling. It was a party. And they had created this amazing technology to prevent these evil Calamity Ganon force from coming back to Hyrule. This technology involved creating a whole bunch of machines, guardians, that would roam the territory, making sure that if this force ever came back, that they were ready for it. And in addition to that, there were these four divine beasts, these massive machines in the shape of animals that guarded the four corners of the kingdom and again kept watch for this evil spirit, this evil force ever coming back. It did come back, and Link's counterpart Zelda had a huge fight with Ganon. Zelda is like pretty much the most powerful person in Hyrule, but she wasn't able to defeat Ganon. The only thing she was able to do was contain him and trap herself and him inside of a palace. And in the battle, when Ganon came back, Link was wounded, so Zelda put him to sleep, where he remained for the next 100 years until awaking. And that's how this game begins.
Yeah, and one thing that I think is interesting about the Zelda games is that there are a lot of them, but it's like a lot about like repetition. It's like the universe, there's always like some kind of, you know, apocalypse. Breath of the Wild definitely feels like post-apocalyptic. Like you see all the ruins of these like past civilizations, and even from 100 years ago, like the Zonai is like past civilization, but there's like the ruins of like the town of Hyrule. But yeah, it's always like collapse and then rebirth, and then the cycle like keeps going. So that's like the kind of cosmology of it within the lore of the game, but also the games themselves, right? Like it's just like staging that narrative over and over again. Now, I have not played any other Zelda games. Like I got Link's Awakening for Switch, the like kind of 3D remaster, and it's very cute, but you know, I was okay putting it away after playing it for a while. But Breath of the Wild feels a bit different. I don't know, Desmond, you know so much more about the other Zelda, so you want to say a few things about, I know you have some favorites.
I started playing a little bit at just the very first bit of a Zelda game for the N64 called Ocarina of Time. And I haven't gotten into it enough yet to really say anything. Obviously, I played A Link to the Past for the Super Nintendo when I was a child and beat the game several times over. This game, though, Breath of the Wild, is very, very special. It might not have the number one place in my heart because, again, nostalgia, how can you beat it? But what is so wonderful about this game, the thing that really, really makes this game for me, is that you wake up and you're in this place called the Shrine of the Resurrection, and you come out and you have a map, as you do in many RPGs or role-playing games, and you're like, man, this world is pretty big. You can't really see all of it when you start moving around, but you're roaming in this very expansive three-dimensional space with all kinds of terrain, mountain and valley and forest, and it's a very beautiful game. They decided with the soundscapes of the game to be very minimalist, so there's no like constant music playing in the background for a lot of the game. When you run into monsters and fight them, there's music. Sometimes when you go into shrines or face bosses, there's music. But a lot of the time, there's just this really minimalist piano stuff going on in the background. It's extremely pleasant. And so you're exploring this really well-done landscape. Like, I haven't played a lot of video games, right, in the last 20 years. And I look at this game and I'm like, this is gorgeous. Like, it looks and feels so wonderful. The physics of the game are spectacular. Things move and fall and rise up the way that you expect them to. The character moves, once you get used to the controls, in a way that's really intuitive. And it's just really pleasurable. But then you start to realize as you get into this game that the map is just gigantic. It's so big. And each of the four kingdoms that we mentioned before has a different terrain. And each of them is ruled by a different group of people with a different story and different kind of powers and things to offer to Link on this adventure. Because essentially what he's trying to do in this game is that when Ganon came back and fought Zelda, these four guardians, these huge beasts that had been created to stop him, Ganon actually successfully took them over. And so throughout the game, Link has to go and retake these beasts by going and entering them and fighting a boss and turning them back to the good side. And then he has to go into the castle and, of course, rescue the princess. What would a video game be otherwise, obviously? So you want to talk, actually, Shama, about the four worlds and the four very interesting, let's call them races of people who live in this game and how they're designed and how they construct their worlds, because the world building of Breath of the Wild for me is what, along with the landscape and the incredible physics, makes this game so just replayable over and over again.
Yeah, and all of those things are connected. So like you said, it's exploration. It's not really guiding you. It's not hitting you over the head with like, go down this path, go down that path. Like, you can really, like, there are infinite ways to play this game. So with the music, each one of these, you know, town civilizations have their own music, they have their own aesthetic, and it's very fleshed out. Like, the NPCs, you know, there's all kinds of side quests in all of the little towns. I want to bring up one thing that was so special to me about these towns, and it's not one of the four that has a champion, but there was a time, this is like very typical of Breath of the Wild, where you don't know where anything is, like if you haven't like defogged that part of the map. At nighttime, skeletons emerge from the ground and can, you know, attack you. That was kind of happening to me. So it was nighttime. I was behind Hateno Village. I was like alone and scared, you know, as Link often is, you know, early on in the game, like very, very much like, you know, basic armor, like basic weapons.
Yeah, you're very vulnerable.
Yeah, you are very vulnerable. And it was nighttime, and I was just like wandering around. Like, you know, the one thing that's good for like new gamers is that you can fast travel anytime. So like if you really, really like you're getting chased and you're gonna die, you just like open your map and just like get the fuck out of there like immediately. And I think that was so helpful for me as a new gamer. Now I play games where like, you know, in Witcher you have to go to a signpost, in Horizon you go to a campfire, but like I didn't know anything about video games. Like Breath of the Wild is very accessible for these reasons. You can also just have like 50 apples in your pockets and just like keep eating them like during the battle to get health back. But yeah, so I'm wandering around vulnerable, skeletons chasing me, and I'm just using my paraglider to like go around. I'm like, where should I go? And then there's some like lights flickering in the distance, and I was like, okay, let me just go there. I have no idea what it is. And I just paraglided into Llorelin Village, and it was one of the most magical moments of a video game ever, because it's such a beautiful little fishing village, and it doesn't exist for any narrative reason. And that's like such a great thing about Breath of the Wild. The other towns, you know, you have to meet somebody there, there's like stuff going on, right? They're the champions. But with this town, they're just like it's kind of like Pacific Islanders. They're like vaguely brown, and they have like huts, and it's like their whole culture is kind of centered around fishing. And so then I just glided in, and I was like safe again because I was in a town and I met all these new people. And of course, there's lots of side quests there too. So there's the main story of Breath of the Wild. You can leave the Great Plateau as soon as you get the paraglider and glide go straight to Ganon with three hearts and do that.
And die.
People, you know, on YouTube and stuff, they do that, right? Like they're like the serious gamers who've like figured out all the tricks. But if you let the game kind of just like unfold in an organic way, do all of this exploration, you'll really be rewarded. So Llorelin Village, yeah, that's one that's not part of the four. So the joke about the four races, let's say, one of them is like, they're like rock, they're kind of rock people. They are, you know, workers, they're comrades, they call everybody brother. It's like a really wonderful, you know, kind of like they live on Death Mountain, the lava. So Daruk is the champion there. I think he's like the sweetest, maybe of all of the four. Mipha.
This is the Goron.
Yeah, the Goron. Sorry. Yeah. So the Gorons are, yeah, they're the workers, like they're the comrades. And I think their gender is like, there definitely are like women Gorons, but I don't know, like it's hard to tell. Like we don't have to make it like legible to us in our like human bodies or whatever, but they do like to call people brother. And then there are the Zora's Domain, which is so gorgeous. And you have to go through this gauntlet of so many enemies to get there, while Prince Sidon, who's the contemporary champion, like he is the little brother of Mipha, who was the Zora's Domain champion. He's like swimming beside you. He's like, I know that you can't swim on these waterfalls, but like you're doing great. And so you're just going through this gauntlet. You finally get to Zora's Domain, and it's this beautiful, you know, these like how would you describe it? Like they're really into silver. So there's these like silver towers and pools and fish people.
It's a water world because yes, they're aquatic based beings. And so they have created out of the waters this like shimmering palace, series of palaces that they live in. And it is like really spectacular. The music changes when you go in there, and it's really, really beautiful. So you have the Zora, the Goron, And in the desert section of the map, you have the Gerudo, who are all women and who are really interesting because men are not allowed in Gerudo Town. So Link actually has to get a costume and dress differently to disguise himself so that no one knows his gender. And if you try to enter Gerudo Town as Link without your costume on, or if you take your costume off while you're there, you're going to be immediately expelled by the guards. Everyone in Gerudo is like buff and a warrior and a soldier and is like always ready for battle.
Link is non-binary though, I think. So, you know, lots of people are attracted to Link in the Gerudo, women's Gerudo outfit. And yeah, like, Link is very small, even like for and slight for a human. But I think that Link wears that outfit very well. And yeah, the Gerudo women, they do leave in order to find partners. And there's a dating course that you can take in Gerudo Town. But as you're wandering the rest of Hyrule, you often run into Gerudo women who are like, I'm out on the prowl. Like, I can't find like a boyfriend in Gerudo Town because there are no men. So you can, there's a Gerudo in Lorelin Village. There's a Gerudo in the Death Mountain in Goron City. So yeah, you see them all around.
Wandering and looking for adventure and love.
Yeah, exactly. And
of course, we cannot forget about the fourth zone. Let's call it a sky environment where a city is constructed upwards. And the easiest way to get there, of course, is to fly there. And that is because the people who live there are the Rito, and the Rito are birds. They are very cool. I think both of us, probably our favorite character, side character in the game, is from this race. His name is Cass, and he gives you clues for a lot of the parts of your journey. He just appears bearing an accordion, and he will often play you a song which contains a riddle or a clue for the next thing that you have to do on your quest. Now, as you mentioned, Shama, one of the huge strengths of this game, especially if you're not a huge gaming type of person, or you just, like me, love wanderlust and just love exploring without having to like play by the rules, is that this game doesn't punish you for not having an understanding of where you're quote unquote supposed to go. It doesn't really insist that you do most things in the game in a specific order. And so you're just free to wander around anywhere and everywhere that you can go in the map and run into things and people and adventures. Most people who talk to you have a little bit of a story, maybe a little side quest for you to ask them to help with. It is just fun when you get into this game and you can spend a very long time aimlessly wandering around until something happens. You mentioned the paraglider. You know, this is like the first item that you get that allows you to jump off of cliffs and just start floating. And you kind of have to work to master it at the beginning. But it's like so many of the things in this game, really intuitive, extremely satisfying. You can jump from mountaintops and see things. And when you're in one part of the map and you're looking out from a tall place especially, you can see the geography and the detail of huge other parts of this map that are incredibly, incredibly far away. Now, later on in the game, you unlock stables that allow you to have horses. You can ride horses in the game and you can take care of them and take them to a stable, give them a name, make sure that they're fed and cared for and groomed, and then take them out and ride them to go to different parts of the map. It's just really about like curiosity, exploration. You know, you talk about coming to Lurelin Village and just that amazing scene as you kind of plop your way in there. There's so many moments like that in the game there's so many like really surprising and terrifying things that happen. One of the weaknesses of the game is that there are different monsters that are always coming to challenge you or that you come upon in the quest. And there isn't a lot of variety in the monsters that you have to face. So the battles with them can become monotonous after a while, especially if you're dying. Well, one of the good things about this game is that you don't really get punished too badly for dying. You kind of just continue back from where you were before. You don't lose too much and you continue on.
Yeah, I would say that it was not my experience that that's a weakness, because I played this so early on in my gaming journey. And so I felt like I kept being challenged because they do get harder, and they're also like different elemental varieties of them. So you can have like the Lizzo, who's like a fire Lizzo, or like an ice Lizzo. And so like, you know, I felt like personally, because I was like so early with my gaming, I was challenged quite a lot. But yeah, I mean, it's the exploration, you know. I have heard some people say that they think that Breath of the Wild is boring. And I'm like, that's just like, you're a different kind of gamer then. Because I think that for me, so much of it is like, I could turn this corner and like a guardian, which is like the robot, like really hard, really, really hard enemies, like could just be around the corner. And then the piano music, there's like special guardian piano music that like triggers your fear as well. But yeah, like those guardians, you can't play them. Like, you can't fight them really until you're like 15, 20 hours into the game. They're really like, they'll one-shot you until you like grind some shrines and like get some more hearts and good weapons and stuff and learn how to parry. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like it was a challenging game for me as a new gamer. But maybe people say like, oh, they think it's like too easy or whatever. But like, that wasn't my experience. Also, you can make it harder and you can do like a master mode that's extremely hard. So I don't know. I think the game is like very fair because, yeah, there's like weapon degradation. People don't like that either. But you can always find new weapons, you know. So I think that it felt like part of the world that things decay. So like it seemed to connect to kind of the story that, yeah, like you would find like a rusty sword that was like pretty shit and like you could hit somebody a few times. But yeah, I don't know. Like I think it's like a very fair game. I know that's something that you were thinking about, like what's fair, unfair with their puzzles and stuff too. So do you want to talk a bit about that?
You can get a lot out of this one game if you're the type of person who just wants to play and figure out things and explore. The amount of little detail that you have to understand if you're not looking for all of the tips and clues and suggestions online, you know, you can just figure your way through this. An example for me is rain is a constant feature of this game, where you'll just be going along. So the game operates on its own kind of 24-hour clock, where sometimes it's daytime, sometimes it's night. You see the changing of this of the day. You see the moon come up, the moon go down, sun come up, sun go down. Again, it's like extremely beautiful. You can take pictures in this game. And because I'm somebody who likes to take pictures in real life, there would just be like sometimes scenescapes in the game that I'm like, wow, that's really pretty, and I just capture a little picture of it. Taking pictures is actually a required part of the game to like, I won't spoil that for everybody, but there are certain quests where you actually have the capability to take pictures and you have to snap pictures of things in order to get ahead. But like, one thing I didn't figure out for a while was that it would start to rain, and sometimes when it rains and starts to rain really hard, there's lightning. And I remember the first time I got struck by lightning, and I had absolutely no idea what had just happened. I'm running around and I see this little like zzz, zzz, zzz happening on my back, and it starts getting more frequent, more frequent, more frequent. And then suddenly this huge bolt of lightning comes and strikes me down. It's very early in the game, so I have almost no health. You gain more as you go along. And I'm instantly dead. And I thought, oh, this area of the map that I'm in is cursed. There's some kind of curse going on here. I should not go here until I'm stronger. And what I didn't actually understand is you can equip your weapons and your shield, which is when you have them right on your back while you're running around, or you can put them away. God knows where Link keeps all of his gear, all of his food. We're going to get into cooking, I imagine, at some point. But magically, he is able to just kind of hide these things as long as you put that on. But if you forget to unequip your metal sword, your metal shield, or any metal items that you are carrying, and it starts raining heavily and it is lightning outside, if you don't unequip your items, the lightning will eventually strike you. And that's why that zzz, zzz, zzz was coming from. It was giving me a warning that I hadn't done that before I got struck. And I had to die from lightning about 15 or 20 times before I finally figured this out. What I like about this game, and you mentioned it earlier, Shamat, is that at the beginning, when you're really weak, one of the best strategies in this game, as with life itself, is just to run away when you're in trouble and don't know what else to do. It's to run mm-hmm. from danger instead of trying to confront it head on. And so you have to figure out little things like this as you go along. And it's really, really satisfying. And I think that leads us nicely into like cooking food, mm-hmm. because you pick up all of these food items along the way. And you can learn how to make meals, many of which are way more nutritious and helpful to you than others. I know this was one of your favorite parts of the game, Shama, so I'm going to let you describe this part.
Yeah, so there are even quests that have to do with this, but it's just like really delightful how like Link doesn't show a lot of emotion, you know, when there are cutscenes or something, for example. So Link famously never talks, right? But there is a moment of joy that we always see with Link, and that's when his recipes are made. And there's like little music and sound effects and stuff that come with it. But basically, like, you can experiment so much with putting different ingredients together. And there's like really, like, there's a side quest with the babies, with Cass's baby birds. And one of them really wants like a salmon meuniere. And so you have to like figure out what the recipe for that is and go gather the ingredients. But it just seems like a really creative little mechanism to have in the game instead of just like gathering apples or something. Or like, you know, Horizon's one of my favorite games, but with Horizon, basically you can just like get some herbs and, you know, replenish your health. Actually, there's cooking in Forbidden West, but you have to go to a cook. The cook cooks it for you. Yeah, like in Breath of the Wild, yeah, you're making lots of meals. There's a kid in Kakariko Village who always wants Coco, who like always asks for different recipes. And so that's like the mechanism to teach you how to do some of that stuff. So yeah, it's a very cute thing to build into the game. And also like this game does not tell you very much, right? So even like in the shrines, in all of the exploration, like you just have to see something and be like, oh, what's over there? I'll just go over there. Or like, what's this like new herb that I've gotten? I guess I'll just stick that in a pot and get a stew going, you know?
I think it's really about why you play games and what is it that you're looking for. I know that I'm definitely usually looking for a little bit of escapism when I'm playing video games and just looking to kind of zone out and get absorbed into whatever is happening on screen, which is exactly why Breath of the Wild works for me, because the world is so immersive and expansive. Little things like the way that the grass moves when the wind is blowing. There are animals jumping and running around all over the place. There are birds and deer and rabbits running around. In typical kind of Nintendo fashion, this is a very wholesome game, I would say. There's definitely a lot of blood and killing of bad monsters, but it's still quite wholesome, I think, in general. It's trying to be a game that wouldn't be too like terrifying or jarring for younger people. And it really succeeds. You mentioned the shrines. I don't think we've talked about that a lot, but the shrines kind of double as little tests that you have to cross to gain more health and more strength. But they also serve as portals so that you can use them to travel. And once you've finished a shrine, you can always travel quickly from one to another. And as the game goes along, that really actually helps you to kind of navigate. But you do want to roam all over the map because there's always something new for you to find and to explore. So the shrines sometimes are really challenging puzzles. Some of them are completely unfair, I'm going to say. Some of them I could not solve without a little bit of help, but I did pride myself. I found every single shrine in the game without cheating and looking online. It is possible to do this even if you have no clue what you're doing when you start out in the game. I had a very distinct feeling of emptiness and letdown when I finally finished this game, because it really is a journey, not destination sort of game. Mm-hmm. And so the end can never really ever live up to everything that builds up to it. My absolute favorite part of this game was actually like a totally not seminal to the point of the game side quest with Cass, the bird who appears with his accordion to sing you songs and give you clues. And at one point, Cass tells you that, you know, he really wants to get back to his family in Rito Village. He misses his children and he's been away from them for so long. And you have a quest, maybe even a series of quests, I can't remember, to reunite Cass with his five little baby bird children who are all musicians practicing a song without him on a cliff. And when you finally reunite them all, he plays his accordion and they all sing a song together. And I was very much here for it. Mm-hmm. This was the ending of the game that I was looking for. It was just extremely, extremely satisfying. And music features very heavily for me in this game, because as a fan of A Link to the Past, one of the really standout things about that game is its music. The music of Link to the Past for the Super Nintendo is pretty varied depending on where you are and what stage of the game you're in. And every so often in Breath of the Wild, they have these callbacks to music that was in A Link to the Past. And for somebody who knew that game and was like transfixed with the music, every time there was a little reference or vignette or a callback to A Link to the Past, I was like, oh my God, I know what this is. And it was like, these are the moments I feel of like gaming for me that are deeply satisfying. Because you know what? When you're like in some like Bokoblin tower trying for the 30th time in a row to kill them because you died, and you're just getting out the hate, like that can be good. Not gonna lie. But that's not really what the satisfying part of the game for me was. Mm-hmm. It was solving some of the really hard puzzles and really like experiencing some of the really like just beautiful or fun moments that it had to offer. I know you are a big fan of Tarrytown. And I think you should talk about that.
Yeah, so Tarrytown is one of the really like beautiful parts of the game. So you buy your own house, And then you can outfit it, and in Bolson, Bolson Construction, that's who you buy it from. But they also, like, once you upgrade it, they'll put little like flowers and books, and it's just like a very, very cute house. But that unlocks a side quest where Bolson, or is it, wait, who's the one who goes to Tarrytown? Is that
You know,
Bolson?
I always forget.
Because Bolson is the owner, right? So Bolson is the one who's kind of like queer coded, wears like pink, and does dancing and stuff. So you're like, okay, yeah, that's like their idea of like being queer coded. Yeah, it's Hudson. Hudson goes and is like, I'm gonna start a new town in Akala, which is a very beautiful kind of fall themed area of the map, like with like red and orange gold trees. It's really nice. So you help build that town by getting all the materials, but also by getting people to live there. And anybody who wants to be a vendor there, their name has to end with Sun, because that's like a that's just part of Bolson Construction. So that's why it's like Hudson, Ronson, Bolson. So you just are on the lookout throughout your travels for people whose names end with Sun, and then you send them over. And this town like builds up little by little, and then one of the women from Gerudo marries Hudson, and there's a wedding, and it's so wonderful. Like, it's just you've built this town like over so many hours. And again, the way that it's integrated into the game is not like this is your active quest, and so you're gonna just like follow that. No, it just happens like as you're traveling, you're gonna meet people, right, to help build this town. And so yeah, and it ends with a wedding, which is very cute, I think. And it's just like an extremely wholesome part of of a very wholesome game.
Yeah, I think Jane Austen would approve, definitely. In general, though, why do you think we both gravitated towards this form of entertainment during the pandemic, outside of perhaps many, many moments of experiencing sheer boredom and isolation? I think that's maybe the easier answer, but I still game now that life has changed from the way that we were in those stages of confusion and fear and isolation. I still enjoy it. I have to say, I don't play as much now as I was, say, a year and a half ago. But, like, what do you think it is about this that is attractive, satisfying, calming?
Yeah. I think that now, especially on PlayStation, I play a lot of games that are narrative based. Like, I just finished all the Uncharted games, which are not exploration, but they're the most fun games. They're basically 3D platformers, but there's only one path, there's one story, there's no like inventory management or anything, but they're so fun. Breath of the Wild is an extremely different kind of game than all of those, and it is also a game that you can spend hundreds of hours in because there's so many different ways to do things. There's so many YouTubes of people doing all kinds of tricks, like launching themselves across Hyrule on like a log that they put stasis on and then hit it lots of time to build up kinetic energy, sit on it. When the stasis, when the stasis is over, all that kinetic energy just launches them, right? So there's so many different ways to do it because the physics are so coherent. There are things that the game makers did not know were possible, but because they did such a good job with like having a logic to the physics, people were able to find those things. So I think it's just, yeah, the exploration, the kind of endlessness of it, that it's not a story. Like, there is a story, right? But it's not a narrative-driven game. It's an exploration-driven game. So you can keep doing that. And I think, yeah, in the deep pandemic, it was really nice to spend time in this world where you weren't being told what to do and you could just kind of wander, but there was always something to do. Like, there was always something going on. You turn a corner and there's a new quest. You turn a corner, there's a shrine. There are some people who like need your help, or they want you to like find something or rescue somebody. And so I think that that has a lot to do with it, just that you can really immerse yourself in this world, and the world has a lot of freedom. It's not immersing yourself in a world like a film or a TV show where it's just taking you on a journey that is very specific and narrow. This is like you just get to actually experience that exploration for yourself. So for me, especially as an early gamer, being so isolated during that time of the pandemic, really like not feeling good, right? It was, I think video games like really saved my mental health during the pandemic. And I still play video games. But, you know, I would say I'm not as much of a newbie gamer. So I'm like playing different kinds of games now too. But that was the appeal for me.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I think it was a lot of very similar ideas to you. I remember when the Grand Theft Auto series of video games came out, and I was never really gaming around the time of GTA in its like prominence. I remember those games. I just didn't have time for video games back then. GTA had a very similar principle in terms of freedom. The difference, though, with Grand Theft Auto, obviously, for anybody who knows that franchise, is that it is a little too close to the dysfunction of the real world that we live in for comfort. Meaning you have this huge map and you could be in Miami or you could be in Vice City or wherever this game is purportedly taking place. And your character is a gang member who runs around or bikes around or drives around or flies a helicopter around. And invariably, if you do something wrong, the police will be chasing you and shooting at you. It's a really kind of on the nose and direct kind of first person narrative. Not exactly first person shooter, although there's a lot of gunplay. And I wouldn't be able to play a game like that during the pandemic because I'd just be like, this is too close to the thing that I'm trying to get away from.
Mm-hmm.
Turning on the news every day to death, dysfunction, neglect, terrible political decision making, and you want to get away from it all, and the thing that you're immersing yourself in, oh my god, that would be too mm-hmm. much. This game is not a real world. It has too many things that are fantastical. That's not to say that this is like I think Animal Farm really comes a lot closer. Like when you talked to me about your experience of playing Animal Farm and what you were creating doing that game, I was like, this really makes sense to me, that this is what you want to do to shut yourself off from all of the horrors that we're kind of faced with every day.
Yeah, I feel like in the first 6 months of the pandemic, like March and 6 months, like starting then in 2020, Animal Farm like saved me because it really was like just a place I could not just escape to, but like a lot of my friends had it. So like we couldn't see each other. So we would just like visit each other's islands and stuff. But I want to say a few things about video game violence, because I think that before I played video games, I was, you know, I do cultural studies. So, you know, I would hear these are like video games make people violent or whatever. And I was like, that's so stupid. It's so stupid that video games would make people violent. Now that I've played video games, I feel like I could, like I have more of a capacity to be, I'm not violent, but like I can understand it. Or I would say, maybe more accurately, like I'm inured to violence in a way that like I wasn't before video games, especially like the ones that I play with like guns and stuff, right? So that's been an effect for me. I'll say something about like the killing in Breath of the Wild. Anybody that you kill in Breath of the Wild, it's unclear what happens to the human followers of Ganon when you kill them, but they are also supernatural. Like there's no corpse that's left behind. It's just like whatever their inventory was that gets left behind. So like let's say that they don't die either. But any of like the monsters that you kill when there's a blood moon, they get resurrected, and they get resurrected stronger. So what's interesting at the end of the game is that you don't get a post-ending experience of the game. When you defeat Ganon, it takes you back right to before you defeated Ganon. But let's say like, okay, I was always thinking like, you know, if Ganon's defeated, then when you kill a Bokoblin, you're killing them for real now, you know? Is there like a denazification program after you kill Ganon where like you, because the Bokoblins, especially, they have culture. right? They do dancing around the fire. They tell each other stories and stuff, right? Like, you see them actually, like, engaging in culture. So it's like they're not, yeah, they're not like automatons or anything. They're not robots like the Guardians. And so I don't know, like, is there ways to save Bokoblins? Like, I think about this because one of the most important games that I've played, I wouldn't say it was necessarily my... It's hard to say this thing about what's a favorite game. Mm-hmm. It's The Last of Us 2. I think it's like a brilliant, important game. There are moments of that game that were the most uncomfortable I've ever felt with any pop culture ever. And I'm not going to talk about this on the podcast, but if anybody wants to talk to me off the podcast about this, I always want to talk about Last of Us 2. But one thing that that game does is it has you kill people, and then you see them as killable bodies, right? Even playing Uncharted, like, Nate Drake is a mass murderer in Uncharted. Like, he's so nice in the cutscenes and, like, his character. But when you're in a kind of combat situation, he'll kill, like, 100 people. And it, like, is never talked about that he's killed so many people, right? What Last of Us does is that it has you kind of play the other side. And so you see these killable bodies as people with full lives that you've just killed in the first half of the game. And it's brilliant about, like, agency and complicity. I'm sure there are, like, scholars who've written about that, or maybe not, I don't know. But it's definitely, like, one of the most significant things about the game that a game like Breath of the Wild doesn't have to think about, because they're not killed. Like, the Bokoblins are not killable bodies because they're not killed, because Ganon will just resurrect them. So you don't have to worry about that. But yeah, I mean, Last of Us, you know, this idea of, like, killable bodies, you know, there's lots in, like, Black studies, like, that, you know, talks about the status of the human and stuff. I think Last of Us 2, Last of Us 1 is, like, anti-Black. I think Last of Us in general, there's, like, an argument to me that, like, the whole world of the post-apocalypse is, like, anti-Black. But as is, like, most of pop culture, like, mainstream pop culture. But yeah, very interesting about who is allowed to be killed.
Not only can you not kill the Bokoblins and the Lizalfos and all of the common enemies that you keep running to in different forms over and over again throughout the game, you're right, you can't kill them, they just come back. But also, you're not really meant to feel bad about killing them, because they're so not human compared to Link. They're so monstrous, they're so obviously just, I want to say, racialized, really. Mm-hmm. I want to say that what you're being shown in this game is a white human protagonist searching to rescue his princess from the dark force and facing all of these ghouls and goblins along the way, a la Tolkien or something mm-hmm. similar. And so who needs to feel bad when these monsters, I mean, look at them. You know, and they, mm-hmm. the Bokoblins, don't some of the Bokoblins,
they're so cute. Like, no, they're cute.
I think they're cute. But don't some of them have, like, little, like, earrings and piercings and stuff like that? Yeah, of course.
That's why I'm saying they have culture.
You know, but I mean, this is a little bit of an on the nose sort of reference to the real world as well, and how conflicts get portrayed, and how in the real world some people are disposable because of the way that they're portrayed and cast in front of us, and who's the protagonist, who is the person worthy of being saved, who's the hero. And you can tell just by looking at people, just by the way that they're presented to you. I remember a distinct feeling of terror when Link first encounters the Yiga clan in this game. The Yiga are so brilliant in the way that they frame them and introduce them to you. They are an incredibly mysterious clan of magical warriors who are extremely powerful and not to be fucked with. And in one of the quests, you have to go into their lair and you have to creep around, because if any of them see you at this point in the game, you are not strong enough to defeat them. The doors will slam shut and you will be forced mm-hmm. to do battle with the Yiga, who you can't usually beat at that point. And I loved the mystery and the kind of, like, ninja warrior kind of aesthetic that they gave to the Yiga clan and their masks and their costumes and everything. So not every difference that was starkly laid out in the game to me was like, I'm not even going to say that they were all necessarily bad. It's a video game based on, I think, an idea that's trying to appeal very much to Western culture. It is what it is.
Like the ways that kind of Japanese like animation fetishizes like particular kinds of whiteness, like with Zelda and Link, right? Like we know this is like a very like facile thing to say, but I think it's interesting. So the four main civilizations, you have like fish people, rock people, bird people, and women, but like specifically like brown-skinned women, right? So I'm like, okay, so like all the brown-skinned women are like in Gerudo, and they're like, you know, very muscular and like literally like emasculating.
But it's interesting because people who do what we do for a living are able to put things like that aside when we sometimes watch a movie, sometimes play a video game. You can still enjoy, even though you notice these things and you're like,
I loved Uncharted. Like Uncharted is one of the most fun games, like especially four. Like I just really, really loved it. It's like hilariously colonial.
Well, you know, I was thinking the other day as I was watching the coronation.
Like, oh no.
No, really. I was like, you know, it's never really occurred to me that Link is a monarchist, and that's like super cringe, super cringe. But yet, like, okay, like I'll go with it.
He's like a monarchist knight, so he's like the cop of the monarchists.
It's pretty awful. You know that
ACAB includes Link.
He would be dragging off the protesters as Charles was trying to get that crown put on his head. You know, Link would be fucking up anybody with a sign that says "Not my king." But what are we gonna do?
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. We can still, this is like one of the main, like, you know, tenets of Replay Podcast is like, yeah, we know, but also we like it.
We decided to do this now because the next game in this series of the Zelda franchise is coming out. And it is, of course, Tears of the Kingdom, the highly anticipated Tears of the Kingdom. And I think we should end off here with some thoughts and anticipations about this game. I'm going to pour a little water on the fire here. I have seen some of the previews of this game, and I am disappointed. I haven't played the game yet, and I'm already like, whoa. And it's because they kept the world of Breath of the Wild that I treasure so much. They have kept it the same in Tears of the Kingdom. You are in the same world that we were playing from this game from 2017. And I just felt like, what is this? Is this an expansion pack? Is this a DLC? Like, why did they have so much time and not create a whole new world? Thank you, Jasmine and Aladdin. But like, you know, I was a little surprised. And what it seems like they've done is that they have kept a lot of the things that we liked from Breath of the Wild and tried to sex it up, tried to make all of these new features of things that you can do in the game. But the landscape and the world looks extraordinarily similar to what we knew from Breath of the Wild. And although I haven't played this game yet, and I'm still going to, and I'm looking forward to doing that, that felt like a little bit of a bummer for me. So I kind of wanted to know what you thought of that.
Yeah, I like it. I disagree. So I think the world is, so they're not releasing a new console, I guess, is the main thing. And like the world is so nice. So I just think that it's, we want exploration. Now there is like air exploration. I think there's going to be underground. Again, with the same console, I don't mind. And I think that there might be some pleasure in being like, oh, this is what it looked like before. So we're seeing the ruins of like what we were playing in Breath of the Wild. Right. And so like, I think there might be something interesting about being in like a different cycle, apocalyptic cycle of the same space. And lots of people like, you know, still are still using their Switches. There's no new Switch. So I don't think there's a reason to to make a whole new world. I think it's going to feel really different. And I'm worried that it's going to be hard because it seems like the mechanics of like attaching things to things is going to be really complicated, but probably it will be as complicated as you need to like need or want to make it. And so there are probably like simple ways to like use that mechanism, but I'm like, you can create any, people are like creating cars and stuff, like to, like all kinds of sticking all kinds of things together.
The reality is that I am so basic when I like something, whether it be music or a movie, or in this case, a video game, I will go back to it over and everybody who knows me knows this. I will just replay, if you will, the shit out of it. And so I have my Breath of the Wild. I guess I was hoping for something that was going to be, you know, a marked departure from that. But I'm, you know, I'm kind of hooked in. I'm still going to play Tears of the Kingdom. And we figured that its advent was a really fun time to look back at Breath of the Wild, to think about other video games that we have played and enjoyed during the last 3 years, and to hopefully stir up some thoughts and memories for all of you listening.
Yeah, so, you know, we love video games. We love talking about the kind of magic of this particular video game. So, yeah, if you have a Switch, totally recommend checking this one out. But also just find something that you like that maybe you can feel that same kind of magic feeling with.
For our fundraiser this week, we're thinking about Alberta and specifically about people who are being affected by the really disastrous wildfires that continue to rage in that province. I was out this week going for my first real bike ride of the year, and I looked up at the sky as the sun was setting, and it was, you know, a perfect crimson circle in a very hazy sky. And I immediately recognized what this was because I remember the wildfires that happened in British Columbia last year and how our skies out here in Ontario turned hazy and the sky and sun changed colors because of all of the smoke that was in the air. We know that upwards of 25,000 people have been evacuated from their homes in Alberta and mostly don't have any clue when they're going to be able to go back. We're thinking about you, and we wanted to offer a little help and support this week in our fundraiser and our mutual aid. And we selected a First Nation in Alberta. There are so many people and communities that need support, and we encourage people to do your research and feel free to find anybody who you would like to donate out there. We decided that we wanted to pick a fundraiser from the Little Red River Cree Nation, which is composed of three Woodland Cree communities. They are one of the First Nations communities affected by the wildfires right now. The GoFundMe that we are posting for them is an emergency request from the nation, and the funds raised will be used to purchase baby items, toiletries, clothing, household items, all the basics that you can imagine people would need after having to evacuate their homes and in many cases not having any clue what they're going to go back to. So please, everybody, give generously to this fundraiser if you can. And again, we encourage you to look to any of the many relief efforts and mutual aid efforts that are happening for people in Alberta. We hope you can all return to your home safely really soon. That's it for us this week. You can find us on Twitter at @replaythepod. We want to thank you as always for listening, and we will see you very soon. Take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening.